Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy. Very good.
G'day, Mark Kenny here from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute. And with another week of democracy sausage, of course, as we edge gingerly towards the end of the year, one Greek letter at a time, it seems. In fact, it struck me this morning that in just 2 months, Scott Morrison has gone from humiliating the French president to taking the government back out of our lives and perhaps now to stepping back into our lives, or if you like, from Omicron to Omicron. But I suppose he has to do something. Parliament has proved to be a bit of a disaster because the government, unlike its predecessors, is really a government in name only. The paucity of its legislative ambition reflects its lack of purpose generally. As I said, the final two sitting weeks of 2021 have gone pretty badly for Morrison's government, largely because it doesn't really have too much of a to-do list, at least not legislatively speaking. One result is that the opposition and the crossbenchers move to fill the vacuum. And another is that the government casts about looking for meaning and purpose, sometimes finding it in ideological ephemera, like its bill to create a specific right for religious people to keep on discriminating as a matter of belief. What a can of worms that is. While Australia has had a hard time in recent years, lunging from devastating drought to deadly bushfires and then on to the pandemic, politically at least, Morrison has been quite lucky. He was lucky to come through the middle of the Abbott-Turnbull Wars, lucky to win an election in 2019 he himself called a miracle, and he's been lucky in a way that some of the big stories that have happened have crowded out the negative stories that the government's had to deal with, like the sexism problems in politics, sports rorts and car parks. All governments have indulged in what is called pork barreling, but this government seems to have taken it to a new level. Let me bring in my regular partner here, Dr. Maria Tafaga from the School of Politics and International Relations at ANU. Howdy there, Maria.
Hello, everyone. How are you?
Really good to have you back, of course. Now, also with us are two highly respected scholars. Ian McAllister is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the Australian National University's School of Politics and International Relations, with which Maria is associated and indeed am I. And one of Australia's most respected political academics. And he's also the lead of the long-running Australian election study. Welcome back, Ian.
Hello, Mark.
And another well-known political scientist joins us for the first time, Professor Anne Tiernan from the Griffith Business School at Griffith University. And welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here.
And your research focuses on things like governing and policy, but also you're interested in kind of pretty arcane concepts like the, or what seems arcane to some people anyway, the concept of caretaker conventions. And I guess we'll be thinking a bit about that before not too long as once the election is called.
I'm pretty interested in integrity and accountability too.
Well, that's good because integrity and accountability is very much what we're sort of, it frames what we're talking about here today because, of course, pork barreling is very much seen within that rubric. Maria, before we get to this new paper that Ian has co-authored on pork barrelling. Pork barrelling itself is pretty old, isn't it? It's been around pretty much since politics has been around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the term pork barrelling, I'm pretty sure, refers to the US politics, particularly to do with the way that votes and party machines used to sort of give out spoils to their supporters, because, of course, voting at that time was not secret, so everyone could see how you voted.
Yeah, and it sort of makes sense in a way, doesn't it? I mean, you've got to the governments are going to promise things, and then they're going to try and deliver for them and get the credit for that delivery and be re-elected again. It's kind of an inevitable process, one imagines, but nonetheless, you can build rules around it. Ian, you found in this paper that you've co-authored with Andrew Lee, the Federal Labor MP in this jurisdiction here in the ACT, you found that pork barrelling is pretty rife, which is, as we know, quite well known. But you've also found that it's possibly more trouble than it's worth, because it doesn't necessarily work.
That's indeed what we find. We were particularly interested in doing some research on this because the Sport Australia grants, normally with these incidents of pork barrelling, you know how grants have been allocated, but you don't necessarily know which have been allocated based on merit and which have been allocated based on political influence. So the data set that was leaked to the ABC was really quite unique in that regard. So we were interested in analysing that to see what extent politically influenced grants affected the vote. What we found was, well, firstly, that there was bias in how the grants were allocated. No surprises there, because there was a very extensive, very detailed, very comprehensive report by the Auditor General, and that's what was found in that report. But what we really wanted to do was to see what the electoral consequences of it would be. And much to our surprise, we found there was no electoral consequences, and we literally could not find any. We looked at the types of grants, the amounts, the number of grants. We looked at particular type of electorates, and there was zero effect. So it was a bit of a mystery to us at the beginning when we looked at it.
Yeah, so this is actually a really neat little paper, and it's sort of in two parts. Ian, can you kind of tell our listeners what's the difference between, I guess, your swing and core voter theories and how they sort of played out in terms of what you were looking at in terms of the data?
Well, the two major hypotheses we had in terms of the effect of grants on particular electorates, one was that grants were allocated to support core voters. So these would be something like the spoils of office. So when your party got into office, it would be able to distribute goodies, money, grants, things like that to your core supporters. So it would really shore up your support. The other hypothesis we had was that grants would be allocated to try and tempt swing voters, people who weren't rusted on to the other party, to actually come and support your side. So we went into the analysis looking at that. We did very extensive analysis on this. And indeed, when we found zero electoral effect, we thought there must be a software error, there might be an error in the data, something like that. We spent many weeks checking everything, and we came to the conclusion that there was zero effect. It's probably fair to say that there has been a bit of research on this in the past because, as Maria mentioned early on, there has been instances of pork barrelling with the Labour governments going back into the 1990s. People have done research on that. Andrew Lee did some research himself. So did David Denimark at the University of West Australia. But they weren't able to look at the electoral effects because they didn't have the richness of the data set that we had.
Yeah, I mean, one of the major strengths of what you were able to do is that because you actually had the color-coded spreadsheet that was read into Hansard, you were actually able to distinguish what was actually a political grant, right, which is different from other research. What I found really interesting about your paper, and I guess might be interesting for you to sort of reflect on, is why it is that politicians do this, even though you found no effect.
Well, we tried to explain this in two ways. One was basically the demand side. So a possible explanation is that voters have a very low opinion of politicians. They just think this is normal behavior. So they don't really take much interest in it. So if there's very large grants come into a particular marginal electorate, it doesn't really impinge very much on their electoral behavior. And we find in the Australian Election Studies surveys that the proportion of people who think that politicians look after themselves has really been increasing incrementally over the last 20 years or so. And in the most recent survey we did in 2019, we find that 3 out of every 4 people we interviewed believed that politicians looked after themselves, that there was really no trust in the political class. But on the supply side, parliamentarians pretty clearly overestimate the effect of these grants on the vote. And Andrew Lee ran a straw poll of 14 parliamentarians, and he asked them a question about the effect on the vote if about $500,000 came in via a grant into their electorate. There was nobody of that 14 who said it would have a negative effect. There was 2 who said it would have a 0 effect, but the other 12 said it would have some effect. And the median proportion of the vote was about 1.5%. So virtually all of the parliamentarians thought there was an effect for these grants.
And I don't suppose this is surprising in a way, but I wonder whether this data, analysing it this way, can uncover the sort of the obverse, that is, the MP who fails to secure any grants. If it is expected that MPs will, you know, feather bed their electorates if they can, and that they're all, you know, they're trying to represent their electors, so obviously winning money from Canberra in the case of federal MPs is something that MPs are kind of, you know, it's normal behaviour for them. I wonder if we should be surprised that it doesn't show up as in a great positive sense, but it might show up in a negative sense if an MP is thought to be a useless log who doesn't get any money for his or her electorate.
I'm sure that's true, Mark, that could be the case. But I think the other thing that's really interesting and topical in terms of the great work that Ian's done is that the Commonwealth's the only jurisdictions where you'd have to go through this kind of exercise to get to the bottom of what had happened in terms of the allocation of grants in the absence of the Federal Integrity Commission. So, you know, it's in lots of other jurisdictions with stronger oversight arrangements, you can get to the bottom of schemes that don't look like that they're kosher and haven't afforded, you know, accorded with the rules. Doesn't mean, you know, there's no pork barreling, of course, but it's just, you know, as we've seen, you know, on an industrial scale in New South Wales as well. But, you know, you do have to account for it at some point, and it can be referred for investigation.
But it doesn't necessarily break any laws.
It doesn't necessarily break any laws. And I mean, I think this is what's really interesting here in terms of the trust kind of deficit that, you know, Ian's traced so comprehensively in the Australian election study. You know, this actually has negative effects. So it might be that you don't bring anything home to your electorates in safe seats, and there's issues around that, of course. But, you know, the fact, I think it really bears out this tendency to govern only for the people who you think support you or through marginal seats. And I think that's a pretty big recipe for cynicism, and maybe the trust impact is something that people should consider more. But I'm sure those MPs whose electorates didn't appear on the spreadsheet or who didn't get a car park, you know, were pretty disappointed and asking themselves the question. Of course, some of those seats that they did go to were pretty safe.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is quite interesting to see the seats that it did go to and why they went to them. We're not really surprised about it, but as you say, Ian, the really extraordinary thing about the revelation with what became known as sports rorts in media shorthand anyway, was that there was you know, you could look at all of those applications and see which ones were allocated, and you could see, by virtue of a very handily color-coded spreadsheet, you could actually see the consideration that government was making as to where those monies were going to be allocated based on very much not an absolute match, but very strongly influenced by whether they were marginal seats or seats the coalition wanted to reward.
Yes, no, I think that's exactly right. And we did look at some of the seats where they got large numbers of grants, large amounts of money and so on. There was a very strong incumbency effect there, which is sort of what you'd expect. So if you had a long-standing incumbent who knew how to do these various things, then there was a benefit to the electorate. The other thing we found, which is hardly a surprise, was that a lot of these grants disproportionately went to National Party seats and Liberal National seats in Queensland.
Yeah, so regional seats, yeah.
Absolutely. So again, going back in time, the research that was done in the 1990s showed this very clearly, that the National Party was very much getting a lot of grants that possibly they shouldn't have based on the merit of it. I mean, what we did find in terms of the 680-odd grants that were actually funded, we find that based on the Sport Australia rating, 272 of those were based on merit, but actually just over 400 were not. So there was more grants apparently awarded based on political influence than based on merit.
Which is a shocking finding.
But a potential new supply side theory, right, or hypothesis in terms of, is this what the role of the Prime Minister's office has become, to oversee and do things in this way? It's it's another potential explanation, I guess.
And this happened, a lot of these grants happened, I mean, the role of the Prime Minister's office has been denied and downplayed in all kinds of ways. Essentially, we're led to believe that the Prime Minister had no personal involvement in this, and it's always, it's been a pretty unsatisfactory process. But after the sports things come out, we had the revelations about the car parks fund, which was an even bigger sum, bigger aggregate of money. And I'm really interested in this because it does sort of intersect with the caretaker period, with election campaigning and the like. One of the justifications that put up in the car park case is that these grants didn't need, or these funding allocations didn't need any objective consideration against criteria or by the objective public service, because they were election promises. That's a pretty creative way of putting it, I suppose. But many people would say, "Oh, well, MP stands up at an event, promises as part of his or her campaign in that seat that they'll deliver money for a particular project that's going to relieve congestion in the area. Delivering that then becomes a matter of bond, the MP's word being his or her honour."
Yeah, that's right. And also the more innovative tactic, if you like, of consulting with candidates about things that would be elected. So, really it's I think there are laws, I think there are names for it, aren't they? Aren't there sort of, vote for us or else you don't get this thing that our candidate promised with their fake check, even though they were a candidate. So, I think this is it's just hyper-partisanship. And fuels all the cynicism that we've kind of talked about. But then it leaves the government on the other side with the delivery problem. So you have a bad process, you don't use criteria, and then you're accounting not only for the fact that, this was, these promises were made, but then that they're not delivered. And so then, fuels the you're not delivering kind of problem. So I think in lots of ways, the Commonwealth is now the only parliament without a fixed term period. There's been some, real extraordinary lack of restraint shown before the 2019 election. I see no evidence of anything that suggests that that will be less the case in the lead up to 2022. And I just think it's really concerning. In fixed term parliaments, the caretaker period or the reminder for people to stop weaponizing incumbency, happens about 3 months out, or even 6 months out, knowing, on appointments and that kind of thing, knowing that that the caretaker period will begin. So, I think this is a really significant problem in the Commonwealth jurisdiction, and it's no surprise that the trust data is showing up the way it is in the AES.
Let's take a quick break there and be back in a moment.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, Ian, in your paper, you actually start discussing this whole problem by citing the case of Georgina Downer in the seat of Mayo in the 2019 election campaign. And I think Anne was, this was the case Anne was referring to before we took a break then also, because it was quite a sort of emblematic of the broader problem here. Not only was this a case of, effectively pork barreling to try and win back a seat that had been a coalition duel for a Liberal duel in the Adelaide Hills for a long time. And there was Georgina Downer, daughter of the former member Alexander Downer, seeking to do that. But Georgina Downer fronted up at an event with this huge novelty check. I think it was for about $127,000 with the party logo and her picture on it. It was, I don't know, 2 meter check or something ridiculous like that, as these novelty checks are. She's doing it as the candidate, not as the MP, which really, you know, bells the cat about how cynical this whole process is. And I guess that's the sort of thing. It's one of the more egregious cases of not even really trying to hide what is going on here. Public dollars effectively being used to campaign and garner votes.
I think that's right. That was the event that really started off the inquiry. There was a formal complaint made that stimulated the Auditor General's report. And then, of course, various things started to come out. And as I mentioned before, the Auditor General's report is really very comprehensive. They had access to all sorts of data, and they were able to go back and look at how grants were allocated and so on. Of course, they didn't look at the electoral effects because that really wasn't their job. I suppose the sort of thing that interests me is how this will feed into the next election, which is what Anne was sort of alluding to before. One of the things we find in the election study surveys is that the sort of personal qualities that voters rate in leaders is leadership and integrity. So they're much less interested in things like competence, intelligence, compassion, leadership qualities like that. Something like this and a series of scandals, as we've seen in various other ways across the states and territories, really does undermine integrity. I suppose the thing that might save the coalition at the next election from losing votes over this is that voters are so cynical now, they probably think that both parties do it. So really, there's not much to be gained or lost in the whole process.
And Maria, that's a very good point, isn't it? I mean, we've talked about this, that very corrosive reduction we often hear where people say, oh, all politicians lie. And it really just obscures the gravity that should be attached to, you know, some quite significant lies that are told. Once we accept that all once we decide that all politicians lie, then nothing's all that serious. And we might have the same problem here, that this is a process, as I said at the start, it's as old as politics, really. Plus, I think a lot of people would probably say, well, look, I want my MP to be fighting for my area. We all remember, for example, someone like Brian Harradine, the senator for Tasmania, who was who was lauded really for his single-minded pursuit of securing money for his electorate. His electorate, being a senator, was the whole of Tasmania, but he made no secret of trying to secure a better deal all the time for Tasmania. Many voters actually like that kind of loyalty to their particular constituents.
I think that you're right in the sense that we are kind of in danger of people pricing in this kind of behavior because they've seen it many times. But I actually do. I guess I sort of wonder, or I have a hunch, that partisanship probably interacts with this pretty heavily. So if you're voting for the party that is currently engaging in, the corruption, right, the incumbent, then you're probably more likely to say stuff like, well, all parties kind of do that. Or if you're leaning towards voting for that party, where I think this is actually kind of interesting is the way that these integrity issues are really fueling these independent candidates from often older women who are leading these voices of or independence candidates in traditional blue ribbon seats, right, in coalition party seats, because they are disturbed and upset about the lack of good governance, because integrity, I think, as Ian sort of said, is, you know, one of those leadership measures that are considered important by voters because it goes to character, right? And it goes to whether or not you can keep your promises and your intention, right? You might be incompetent, but at least you're trying. But I think one of the kind of risks that has sort of emerged, and we sort of see this with the car park scandal in particular, is that, you know, like competence and integrity are now coming into question, and it kind of links up with a bunch of negatives that the government has simply by virtue of being quite an old government. And the fact that, like, I guess I'm not convinced people really care about or will change their vote based on the fact that a car park is being built in the local area. I want to know who that voter is who suddenly thinks, yes, that's going to make a really big difference, particularly when they are, you know, often in fairly safe seats or in marginal seats. I just don't think the number of voters out there who would switch parties is that high.
Well, I think you're on the money there, if I can put it that crassly, if crassly is a word, because that's really what Ian's data points up, that it isn't having that much effect.
It is having an impact, I think, in a different way. I mean, I agree with all of that. I think it's very interesting that Dominic Perrottet, having inherited, you know, pork barreling is normalised with all of the revelations from the New South Wales ICAC, has ordered a review of the extent to which that's the case. Now, that might be the opportunity afforded by John Barilaro leaving as coalition partner, you know, leader. But I think the deterrence effect is quite interesting in New South Wales. And I think, you know, it reminds me, actually, just listening to Maria, it reminds me of the way that the Howard government accumulated a whole series of negatives around integrity that really started to build from 2001 to 2004, but then really came home in 2007. So maybe it takes time, but I do think that suite of negatives does and can accumulate.
That's a really interesting point, because Howard himself used, remember that term he used to use, barnacles on the ship, and they would scrape a few barnacles off to get to an election to, give them a better chance. And perhaps these are the kinds of things that eventually, as you say, and just slow the whole thing down, that eventually make the vessel of government, this government, nowhere near as efficient as it used to be, because it's carrying all these accumulated deficits from things that it's done wrong.
If we remember that memorable phrase of Kevin Rudd's during the ALP launch in the 2007 campaign, this reckless spending must stop. And that's the point, right? Like, I think often this is sort of discussed in like a kind of trivial kind of way, like what will be the electoral impact, do punters care, you know, the awful language of, you know, punters and voter land, right? But these are actually these are actually public monies. These are foregone opportunities. These are monies that are effectively being wasted in a gross and unethical kind of way that could be actually spent on stuff that's good, right? If we think about how much the Minister for Families, Anne Rustin, reminded us is being spent on domestic violence by this government, I think she said it was $1.1 billion. That's with a B. Well, if we look at the accumulated sports rorts, the swimming pool thing, safety water safety one, and the car parks, like that's $800 million with an M, right? That's actually not that much less. Some of these car parks will never be built. Some of these toilet blocks were not required. This is actually your money that is being wasted. And part of it is the why this conversation happens this way is because I think the way these are covered journalistically, too much emphasis is placed on pork barreling as a political tool or a tool in the armory kit, and not enough on the actual substance of the actual spending, right? And in trivializing this lack of good governance and accountability processes, journalists are kind of playing into this, playing into the politicians' kind of game that it actually might matter about pork barreling, that, you know, voters like this stuff, or that it gives them some kind of advantage. And it feeds voter cynicism, right? Because, well, it doesn't matter that, you know, they're all like that, or, you know, it doesn't really matter who I vote for. And when I go and look at the mainstream media, I'm not seeing them holding an elite to account, right? I'm seeing them effectively affirming what this elite is already kind of doing. And I think that's actually like the sort of biggest story that we've got going on here over the decade, which is, you know, we kind of got one set of elites that is not really doing the job that it used to do for another set of elites, which is to hold it to account.
Yeah, it's a good point. Ian, you mentioned strong allocation of monies to regional seats, for example. I wonder whether your analysis can measure things like the simple announcement value of some of these grants. You've done a bit of work on that. You've come up with two frames, which is media release theory and check size theory. What does your research show there?
Well, we really didn't find any effect there, but it's probably worth mentioning that the way we did the analysis, we were looking at the changes in the vote within electorates. So we weren't able to drill down to ordinary voters and actually ask them what they thought about the whole process. What Maria was saying before about misuse of public money and so on is very interesting, because we're talking about sports rorts and car parks and things like that. But of course, there's a whole range of other things where government can redistribute resources. Things like membership of statutory authorities, diplomatic postings, a whole range of things where I would have thought sports rorts and things like that were really probably just the tip of the iceberg, and both sides of politics basically do it. The problem, I think, in that behind all of this is the rise of the career politician, which is really altogether a new topic, because what we've seen in Australian elections is that there's an ever-decreasing ideological and policy difference between the two major parties. But at the same time, we've seen a much greater increase in very intense partisan debate. That's actually happened in a range of countries, not just in Australia. So the problem there, I think, is that career politicians are in there to win, and they're not particularly interested in looking after the management of public monies.
But just going on that that point about media release theory and check size theory, I mean, essentially those two theories for your analysis were, the media release theory was sort of the value you get from perhaps a number of smaller grants. I think you compared, for example, or you cited the difference between, say, two grants of $10,000 to two community organisations in an electorate versus the single grant of $20,000 that might go to a sporting club or whatever. And obviously, in the latter case, the larger quantum could allow for a more substantial improvement in amenity in a particular club or whatever it might be. But the other one, the former one, the two $10,000 checks might allow for two different appearances in the local pages of the in the pages of the local press. So I guess, and the criteria might be different as well depending on the size. But you say you don't discern any difference in terms of the overall political.
No, we really didn't find very much of a difference in that. Again, I think a lot of these were directed to sporting groups and things like that. So they were improving, say, lighting after dark or change facilities. So I rather suspect a lot of these things were affecting relatively small groups of voters. And they probably expected that these things would happen anyway at one point or another. So it really didn't affect their view of politics and how they would vote in the 2019 election.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that interested me is that you've done this paper with a former ANU academic who is now himself a member of parliament, so presumably is engaged in representing, you know, sporting clubs and so forth within his area, this being Andrew Lee. Not specifically going to his role here, but I wonder whether you considered, the two of you considered as you were writing this, the sort of political process, like the granular process within an electorate, particularly for a regional MP. It might be about keeping the mayor or mayors essentially happy, might be having good relations with the local chamber of commerce, with the chairs of the major sporting teams, the principals of the local school. These people are kept essentially happy, if I can put it in that broad way, by an MP who's in their fight, seem to be in there fighting for the local community and scoring the odd parcel of dough for this or that project. And the word of mouth value, you can imagine, works quite well. Now, that may not so much show up as a spike in votes, but it might stop a slump in votes that MP might otherwise get, particularly if the broader party for whom that MP is a member is travelling badly, is about to be tossed out of power, for example. Is it sensitive enough to look at that effect?
And not in terms of the data set that we've got. We did talk a bit about possibly opinion leaders within the electorate. Maybe party activists might be more influenced than other people. It was not something that we could really measure with the sort of data that we had. It would require a different methodology. Now, we did find that there was an incumbency effect. So it was pretty clear that an incumbent was more likely to get grants and so on for his or her electorate. But in terms of drilling down into that and looking at the local context and so on, it really wasn't something that we could do.
Yeah. And just finally, there's been a hell of a lot of attention on all of this term, much more so, I suppose, than is normally the case because we've had these quite egregious examples. Any thoughts about whether that in itself is going to have a sobering effect on parties? I mean, as we all know, we're heading into an election. Things look like they're very finely balanced. Do you expect that will have a sobering effect, or will we subsequently learn that this whole practice?
I wish I could say I thought there was going to be a sobering effect, Mark, but I think already the appointments have begun. The appointment of people, you know, to key roles has begun. From decisions made but not announced are sort of totaled up in the budget and ready to go. I think it's going to be all out. And I think, you know, the desperation, the government thought it was going to lose in 2019. So, you know, all bets were off. But I think it's the same in 2022, which is just indicative of how corrosive this stuff is. Interestingly, Bridget Archer, member for the marginal Tasmanian seat of Bass, breaks ranks last week to vote on the integrity and accountability issue with the independents and the crossbench. So it's very interesting that some of those marginal seat holders might actually think, you know, the money is with that rather than with more largesse for the electorate. I thought that was a really interesting development last week.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just so cynical and it's so corrosive to our to trust. And I just think that all those community organisations who did apply and who now know that that's how it worked and that they were never in the game, you know, it will be interesting to see if they're a force to be reckoned with in 2022 as well.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And to Maria's point, just a sort of a final question, to Maria's point about these independents, the voices for and so forth that are showing up, it's almost like this is the sort of liberal moderates, mostly female wing on the outside of the Liberal Party that's really saying, well, we haven't left the party, you know, the party's left us, and they're standing up for these integrity issues, they're standing up for climate, they're standing up for conscientious moral representation in politics. And it's going to be fascinating to see if there are some, if there's an aggregate effect of this, but also if there are some surprises in this coming election.
I think that's absolutely right, and very strong on corporate governance, right? Many of them coming from business backgrounds going, this just isn't good governance. I think that debate, you know, is going to be really interesting.
Maria?
Yeah, I guess what is an irony of some of these campaigns is that some of the arguments made that are not around sort of climate or integrity issues are around, you know, make this seat marginal so we get attention, so we get...
Yeah.
You know, so we get this sort of largesse, and that is actually kind of the end point of treating the public purse as an election kitty, or as sort of treating this as just sort of an input on a chessboard rather than the very serious exercise of serving the public in the public interest and the public good.
Yeah, it's a very good point to end on. Thanks very much, Maria, and thanks to Ian McAllister and Anne Tiernan. Really terrific to have you both on Democracy Sausage.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
And that's it for this week. We'll be back next week for another couple of episodes before the end of the year. And, of course, next year it's going to be, looks like it's going to be on for young and old. We know, for example, that there's only 10 scheduled sitting days between now and the middle of the year, which is really quite extraordinary and underlines the point I was making at the beginning, that really we don't see much in the way of an agenda from this government other than getting through the election, which is really what the religious discrimination bill, as it's erroneously called, and the late listing of some sort of ICAC bill, federal ICAC bill, neither of which are likely to come to a vote, but which have been suddenly put on the agenda as if they're urgent after 3 years. That's what that's about. It's about, I think someone described it to me the other day as wedgeslation rather than legislation. It's designed to give the government something to talk about and perhaps to say that we'd deliver this if the Labor Party was for it as well, but they're not for it, and therefore you have to re-elect us. We'll see how all of that goes, but that's for another time. That's Democracy Sausage for now. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.